three-part music class. Feel Music Podcast. What is it, man? Feel Music Podcast. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Frio Music Podcast. In this episode, we feature Digging Dirt. Three of the eight members sat down with me remotely, and we recorded this interview. Digging Dirt is an amazing funk band, soul, blues. They've really got it all, eight pieces, and they work together seamlessly. An amazing act. Hope you enjoy it. Stay tuned. Thank you guys for taking the time to sit down and talk with me. I saw you guys for the first time at Enchanted Forest, and you guys just crushed it. I mean, it was a very unique performance, so props. And thanks for sharing.
Thank you. Yeah. Hell yeah.
That was such a good time. Oh, my God.
That was a fun one. That was a good festival.
Yeah. Festival season is definitely, like, our favorite time of the year.
Absolutely.
Because they just, yeah, people are just so ready for the music. And production-wise, they just pamper us, dude, like, they just, as an artist, like, you feel so honored and so respected when you're there, because they have it all for you backstage or whatever, you know.
Plus there's scantily clad women everywhere.
Well, that helps a lot. Yeah.
All right. So, guys, before we get too deep into the heat of the festival season, I want to start out by having you guys just introduce yourself. Tell me your first and last name and then what instrument you play, and then just pass it around.
Cool. Yeah, of course. My name is Aaron Gottesman, and I play tenor sax.
And I'm Tyler Martin, and I play baritone sax.
And I'm Zach Alder. I do the lead vocals.
Great. Thanks. And you guys are all part of Digging Dirt. Now, Aaron, you are one of the founding members. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yep, way back when, I guess.
How long ago was that?
It was about, I think, 2011 or something like that. We just started... Yeah. Jamming at Joey and Rory's house.
Hmm. Playing house parties and shit.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, take me back there. Tell me about the early days. Like, how was it getting those first house party gigs? Now, I'm sure some of them are your friends, but how did you start
of
gaining momentum and start getting paid for gigs? And just tell me about the struggle at the beginning.
Honestly, I don't know if I'd call it a struggle, because we didn't really have the vision of being an actual band. We were more doing it just because we had so much fun playing together.
Yeah.
It's funny you saying getting paid for stuff. I really don't know when we actually first started getting paid. We were really just kind of jamming for a long time and playing friends' house parties. And then I guess, yeah, you're right. We kind of saw the momentum, saw people enjoyed the music. And then I think we played, we were teamed up with another local band that was kind of more locked into the circuit locally, playing local venues.
Who's that?
And that was Liquid Cactus.
Oh, yeah. Liquid Cactus.
And so we started kind of hopping on with them and opening for them. But I think we first played this party at a local climbing gym here in town where they paid us. And I think we actually weren't even under the name Digging Dirt then. We were still calling ourselves something else. But yeah, I don't know. It wasn't much of a struggle then. It was more of just having a blast playing and kind of enjoying this town. And the way people support music here locally is really something special.
That's amazing. It's great that you guys were just having a blast from the beginning. Now, where were you guys based out of then?
Yeah, that was Arcata. We all came to Arcata to go to school at Humboldt State University, studying various disciplines. But we just kind of became friends through different avenues, different people, knowing different people. And it just happened to be that a lot of us played something. And
I remember the first time I saw Digging Dirt before I was in the band was you guys were playing a barn party.
Oh yeah, Halloween.
On Halloween.
Yeah.
That was good. I was dressed as Fidel Castro.
Oh my God, Tyler.
Yeah.
That's so messed up.
Yeah, we were called Digging Dirt then because I remember we all like put on white shirts. And then just like literally went and like rolled around in the front yard or something to try and get our clothes dirty.
You guys wore overalls too? Or
yeah, overalls and like just white stuff that we made dirty.
Wow.
Theme is important.
Yeah. Gotta have a shtick.
Yeah, those are the kind of the early days. but I think to kind of answer your previous question in a little more depth, like the current lineup of this band is about 2 years old, and I feel like that's kind of when we started making more of an intention, like, okay, we want to venue, we want to make, you know, we want to make this happen.
Yeah, that's where the grind started.
Hit the road, and that, I feel like, was the dawn of, like, the struggle, you know. Was,
yeah.
but, I mean, considering it's been 2 years since we all came together in our current form, and I've been with the band for 2 years, so we've been moving pretty quick, man.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of big steps.
It also kind of started out like, ska, you'd say? Mm-hmm. Sublime-esque. And yeah, ska moved,
reggae.
We've moved pretty far from that into more of a funk world. So we still have some reggae tunes, I guess, but it's much funkier, more James Brown-esque these days, as you heard.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, tell me about some of your musical influences. Now, on your website, you've got a few listed, but... I was just curious, each of you, if any particular musicians kind of stood out and you replicated their work as a child, or kind of mimicked them to an extent until you learned how to kind of stand on your own ground musically.
Yeah. Well, Mr. James Brown, definitely a huge one. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, like the real funk discovery for me was like, I can name a couple, The Meters, their musicianship was so definitive of the funk.
We just saw them at High Sierra.
Yeah. I mean,
basically The Meters, but yeah.
I pretty much cried when I saw them. they literally like turned me on to the funk, you know. And then Eddie Bowe. I don't know. I guess that's not a name that's thrown around as often, but Eddie Bowe is like one of the early producers of funk music in New Orleans during the early to mid 60s. I mean, I think he produced The Meters too, but he was a badass musician, man. And sort of artists like that kind of taught me that funk is a little bit less about having a definitive message and less about having a, you know, tone vocally. It's just more about enthusiasm, you know. Tone helps though.
Absolutely. And what about you, yeah. Tyler? Any influences?
I would say, you know, as a sax player, I'm turned on by guys like Michael Brecker or just the J.B. Horns, all that kind of stuff. More recent influences would be Lettuce, that kind of thing. I think a major turning point, I grew up on ska and loving that kind of thing. I mean, I had my own ska band for a little bit. I've been playing funk around town on Barry sax for a while. But then with Digging Dirt, you know, it's really a great family. We make a great sound. We come together real well. And then something recent that happened that really kind of refocused my practice on saxophone was the majority of us went on jam cruise down out of Miami, and you know, Lettuce, Galactic, Carl Danson, Maceo Parker. It was just loaded with big names, and you know, I think there's this really funny moment that I often reminisce about, where me and Aaron and Josh, the trombone player, were all watching this horn battle between the turquoise horns and Naughty Professor horns. And afterwards, we just came together and we were like, wow, we suck.
We suck.
And I think awesome. that really helped us. I started listening closer. I felt the band kind of refocus more. I felt a lot of us kind of get in ship shape. And yeah, I think that really helped us really come into our own this year as a horn section, I feel. And I know that I can see a lot of the guitar players, or the both guitar players and the bass player, who are also there, kind of really also take it to heart.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tyler, you guys were there as fans, right? You weren't playing?
Yeah. We just went because our trombone player's been going for God knows how long, but he's a repeat offender on jam cruise, and he was just so... He's so stoked on the fest scene, jam bands, and he really shared that with us, and once we saw the lineup, I mean, God, it was just a stellar lineup this last year.
Yeah.
Mm. That's great.
Yeah, we had to go.
Yeah, and what about you, Aaron? Nice. Any influences?
Yeah, you know, it's weird. I feel sometimes like I'm an outlier in this group as far as musicianship. And like you said, Jam Cruise was really kick in the butt to kind of own up and really get with it. But it's funny, I don't know. I think that's why this band was so special to me. I mean, it really revived saxophone for me individually. But it's weird. It's like more of just a feeling kind of thing that we play. You know, I rarely feel like we discuss influences. Sometimes we draw on songs we hear and think like, oh, wow, that's a cool idea. But really, I think what's special about us is we just kind of get in whatever room we're practicing and just start jamming a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of this like, maybe there are these deep-rooted influences, you know, from what I grew up listening to. I mean, I remember my mom had this funk mixtape in her car when she would drive me to school every morning, and it was like, I was always hearing like Brick House and Love Roller Coaster, these kind of like funny, classic, just funk songs that maybe I listened to a bunch, you know, don't realize, but they're in me, you know, and James Brown as well. But it's hard for me to really like pinpoint exact influences. And I think that's what's so cool, though, is that we've kind of just played what's kind of in us. And what makes it so special is that, you know, we're all just these friends that got together because we jive as people. But then really our musical tastes just kind of naturally flow well together as well. And I'm sure the guys have influences they draw on, but we really just kind of play us a lot of the time, which is cool.
Yeah, sometimes we get in a room and you know, we'll jam out and I'll be like, oh, that's pretty hip. And Zach's laying something down with vocals. And then 2 weeks later, it's a fully formed tune, just kind of all of a sudden.
Yeah,
that's awesome. So walk me through some of this creative process, because I know the whole band is not represented here on this call. So given that, and I know we've got 3 of 8, is that right? 8 you're working with?
Yeah, that's true.
All right.
That's right.
So when you're in the flow or you're starting to jam, you're starting to get things down, you know, I found it hard to work with so many creative people with so many ideas. So how do you kind of battle test your ideas and see what works and then realize that that idea clashes with the initial one and kind of work it all out creatively?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this thing happens in such a weird order over different songs. I would like to think that for the majority of it, the rhythm section, the drums, bass, guitars sort of lock in a groove. They sort of just, one comes out of the ether and they just capture it and they do a thing. And then, in no particular order, the horns come up with a thing and I come up with a thing to kind of fill the gaps that we see are available. I think funk particularly is a genre where it's very easy to do too much. And so in communicating through the creative process, I think a lot of the things that get said are like, I think, you know, there's a little too much clutter here. This is too long, mm-hmm. you know, and just tighten it up, shorten it up. And then everything finds its own pocket, you know, and that's what funk really is to me, is the pocket, you know, knowing when not to play. And but gosh, I want to, you know, the first album that we made, the really long album, a lot of those were dirt tunes for years and years, and I feel like I just showed up and put lyrics over them. And same with the horns, they might have tweaked some things. Mm-hmm. But there are some songs where, like, an individual bandmate will literally tell everyone what to do. Like, mm-hmm. Get Proud is one of my favorite personal songs, just for the fact that I kind of got to come in and tell the bass guitar what to play and tell the, you know, it's like some songs are like that. It's just like someone's own brainchild, and everyone in the band is gracious enough to listen and really dig in and try and project what this one bandmate is dreaming of, you know, in their head. So yeah, I mean, there's a number of ways where that it, you know, goes down.
Yeah, I feel like the word that we always fall back on too to kind of make these decisions Zach is speaking of. I mean, yeah, again, I think most of the time it just kind of happens and we all just, you know, end up enjoying it and we can give each other feedback or tweak. But I think the word we fall back on, luckily, is bandocracy. We really don't have, you know, too strong-headed of individuals in this band that want to really steer a vibe anyway, unless it is really like a brainchild or a song that one person is envisioning. We're all happy to work, you know, with whatever the vision is. But really, it just comes down to a majority vote. If most everyone likes it, and usually it's just that we all like it, you know. But it just kind of comes down to bandocracy, which is lucky, really, for such a big band.
And we like to think that we're a band without a front man, because that
says
way,
the front man.
Just, hey, it's pretty cool.
I hope I don't bark too many orders at you.
No, not really.
I find them the same way James does. His musicians.
He wishes he finds us.
Yeah. And then we start finding you.
Well, that's great. I appreciate you guys sharing that. So I got a question, though.
To expand a little bit, actually.
Yeah, keep going.
Sorry. Can I expand a little bit? I just want to say that, like, it's always a continuous process as well. Like, there's still tunes that are changing just a little bit. We'll change the form just a tad. And so, yeah, I just want to toss that in there.
So the songs, are they ever completed, or are you playing them live and still trying to get a better version of it?
I think we are. And it's funny, like, our feelings change about songs too, especially some of the older ones.
Definitely.
Like, we'll just, you know, we'll completely change the tempo, or, you know, like, really bump up the vibe. And then it's also just kind of this feedback system where we play them live and we see how people receive them, and we kind of fine tune that way as well. So I think they are changing, maybe not always intentionally, but I would say definitely they are.
There's even tunes that we stop playing live because they don't exactly hit with the crowd.
So, all right, going back to kind of that ideation moment when you guys are jamming and figuring out what works. So what do you do once you've come up with something that you think could work? I mean, do you all just fall asleep and forget it in the morning, or do you capture it somehow?
Usually we bust out the iPhone and record it real quick so that we don't forget it. But it's a iterative, whatever that word is, you know, process where we keep coming back at it usually a few times over a few different practices.
And usually the rhythm section has their groove pretty set, pretty locked in when they bring it.
Yeah, so a lot of them work together outside of the band, so they have this time together to kind of create grooves. And so they'll come in with usually some kind of lock groove that really, I mean, that's a big piece of the work done there. And we get to just kind of, you know, put the ornamentals on top to really make it a song.
Yeah, that's such a cool moment when you're jamming and you like everyone realizes almost at once, like, Oh shit! This is our next song.
It is just an oh shit moment.
Yeah, it's everyone goes oh shit, and you get a little high on it. And just the I love that.
My other test for tunes is sometimes I'll bring home the recordings from rehearsal and play them for my girlfriend, and she'll say, "Well, fuck, that fucking tune is stuck in my head now," and we haven't even played
it live.
Finish the tune.
Nice. Hey, let's talk about Bedrock EP. So that's four songs on that one. How was that created?
Five,
I'm sorry. So where did you guys record that?
We went up to Bongo Boy Studios in McKinleyville. It's this old-timey funk master. Jimmy Foote and... That one was interesting because, as opposed to our first album where we basically mowed through 10 or 11 songs in 1 month and just shat an album, you know, and just like bam, you know.
This one,
I feel like we were very we were really wanting to step up and create something that we would be proud of forever, and It's five songs, and we took about 9 months to fully record, mix, and master this little short album.
Yeah, I'm proud of what we did.
Yeah, no, me too. Yeah. I think I like all the songs.
I love the way it turned out.
It was very different. It showed a different phase in life for the band, that we were just taking it more seriously, and we weren't gonna rush the process.
When we
really felt like it was right.
I listen to it, I can hear that we're all clearly better musicians. I like Zach singing better on Bedrock. I think we took our time and did the work.
So tell me about that 9 months. Obviously, or I would imagine, you were not in the studio every day.
Yeah, no.
No.
We still went way over budget.
Part of it is like coordinating 8 people's lives, you know, to be able to come together. So part of that 9 months was just that we couldn't always get in. You know, we're busy at times. But yeah, I think that was a big mind shift, that we wanted to really make the effort to make something we're proud of, you know, not feel rushed. I think that's just kind of a word that's associated with our first album to us, is that we really felt like we just wanted it to get out there. We wanted to have it completed before we went on tour, and it was all just a little bit more rushed. But this, it had that, you know, nice feeling that we were really holding off until we were very pleased with the product.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know, how long was recording? We still only recorded for, I mean, we'd send in individuals to do parts again or something, but maybe it was just only over a few months or something.
I think Rhythm Section laid down tracks pretty quick. I think it was mostly coordinating the horn section.
Yeah, it was getting us together, that's right. And then we spent time kind of choosing, mastering, and you know, really trying to make sure everyone enjoyed the final product. Yeah.
The EQ is really the hard thing. You can obsess over it for months and months and months, and it's just like you're throwing your head against these songs 1,000 times.
Yeah, you get sick
small
of them.
Things too. Yeah.
But it also reflects a certain marriage, like that a professional musician has to their music, is like, You've got to listen to the song like 1,000 times, you know. You need to know it in and out and get it right, you know, which is sometimes it feels sacrificial in a way. It's like, you know, but it's totally part of the, just that relationship to your own music and part of owning your own expression. Yeah.
So Zach, can you tell me a little bit about Leather Tramp? Is that a story?
Leather Tramp. To me, I feel like the poetry in that song is kind of told from the perspective of a character that I see in Humboldt very often. There's sort of a cannabis boom up here, and particularly there's a specific time in the year around the fall where we see a lot of foreign people coming in by foot, hitchhiking, a lot of either from Southern California or different parts of the country, or oftentimes different parts of the world. And I wanted to write that song as a homage to sort of the working class people that sort of just come here and blow up the town during part of the year. A lot of those people are horribly mistreated because they're so anonymous, and
They're definitely the trimmigrants, they're called.
Yeah, that's what they... So I sort of just wanted to, like, express a song from their perspective. Like, the speaker of that song is sort of someone who comes here, finds a bunch of work out in the woods, trimming or growing, and then maybe gets ripped off. The person they work for kicks them off, doesn't pay them. This is something that happens incredibly often here, so I was feeling empathy and a bit of angst, I guess, in that area. And I wanted to wanted a song that someone could listen to maybe when they were down and out and say, ah, that's me. Someone else gets it.
As I ride through them with my girl by my side, I've got nothing to my name, I've got nothing there to hide.
Lyrics, was the music already there, meaning the rhythm section, or was it poetry standalone and then you guys worked around it?
I think it was rhythm section first. Yeah, it was sort of the music was there and the music had a certain emotion to it and the lyrics sort of just came out. And
I think it's pretty amazing actually how off the cuff I think it is really that Zach can come up with lyrics, you know.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts about our.
He doesn't get them like all of them right off there, but I mean, it's like when we're jamming, kind of still really figuring out this tune, he's just kind of churning in his mind as well, and like right then and there can really come up with some good.
It is a great
lines.
Yeah, that one was funny. I think even in the studio while we were recording it, I was penciling in new lines and. Because, you know, it's like a lot of these songs never get written down, you know. They're just sort of happen until you go record them. And then I'm like, okay, I actually have to write these down. What am I fucking saying? I love that about the music is that that's the really organic quality for me is it's a bit spontaneous. And the words that come out are just whatever feels naturally, whatever feels like should come out at that moment. But yeah, I mean, they're spontaneous feelings, but there's always something deeper to that, you know, if you pay attention and zero in on an emotion or a moment, you can extract some meaning out of it. That's a beautiful thing about human beings.
Yeah. So Zach, if we could just dive into your story a little bit. So you grew up with a gospel family, right?
Yeah. My father was a pastor and a drummer. He kind of steeped us in music, and we were, we went to church a lot. A lot of the family was in worship band.
Were you playing then?
Kind of a long. I started playing when I was around 10, and I got on the guitar, and it took a couple years, but yeah, right around like 13 or so, I started playing at. Churches, different little mega churches down in the Sac area. That was kind of weird, but you know, it was cool. It was a good place to get in front of people, you know, and get over that bit, I guess. But I sort of did a lot of gospel music. That's mostly where I learned like guitar chops. You know, I wasn't a singer back then. I was just a guitar player.
Tell me about that transition. Mm. When was the first time you sang in front of people?
I think I was 18, 19.
Where were you?
Yeah. That was not a religious venture. I mean, I guess I had done a little bit of singing when I was traveling as like a missionary kid. So sometimes they would have me do like a song, and I was good enough, I guess, to like rip off some really easy Christian rock lyrics. I don't really consider that to be the real starting point, but the real starting point, I think, was open mics in the Sacramento area, the Placerville area, and I would sing blues. I loved the blues as a singer because there was something so sad and raw and emotional about it. But yeah, that was the first time I really felt like I was coming out of hiding sort of as a singer. And it was just about being as loud as I could. You know, it's just like, how do I just fill the room with a voice? And I don't know. I can think back to those first few open mics and then even those first few shows where other musicians got down with me and there's just that magical feeling in the air. I'll never forget that, how special that was, and how I thought to myself, just like, oh, if I could just do this all the time, that'd be so awesome. You know? And yeah, I moved back to Humboldt when I was about 20, and I had that dream in the back of my mind. It was like, I want to be a singer, dude.
The seed was planted
somehow.
And the rest is history.
And the rest, as they say, is history. Now,
2 years of history.
That's, yeah, that's kind of the abbreviated version. But well, yeah, so I mean, as a singer, I feel like I'm still learning a lot of technique and a lot of stuff that, you know, I sort of started singing spontaneously. I wasn't trained at all. And so now that I'm already a touring singer, I'm like, I best learn some actual technique, not bullshit my way through this anymore. So it's a funny thing. But I mean, considering that was only about 5 years ago that all began. So
that's amazing. Now, how did you end up getting together with Digging Dirt? And this kind of could go for Tyler as well. You know, what is it like jumping into a band that already exists?
You got to learn a bunch of shit.
You got to learn it quick. You know, it's a funny thing. I met a couple of the guys first. Joey is our drummer, really tall, dready cat. He's a cool guy, and we happened upon a little rock and roll cover band that we were both in, and just trying to do coffee houses, casinos, whatever was lucrative, play songs that are familiar to people, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, old blues numbers. And he was already a core member of Digging Dirt, so it was just kind of a side project for him. And then slowly he and I started working together more and more and making funk. And he was like, you know, maybe I ought to just hop in on this other project that I'm in, Digging Dirt, you know? And the first time I actually got into the jam room with them, I was like, oh, wow, this is special. We gotta keep on this.
I think at that time there was like a rekindling of the band, right, Aaron? Is that kind of what was going on?
Yeah, we had all kind of, you know, been finishing up university time or kind of just settling in what we were going to be doing with our lives. But then also just realizing the momentum and potential of the band. And so we were actually like putting the intentions out, like we should find a singer, like we should get a fuller horn section. I think we all realized like that we needed these pieces to kind of really finish and round out the band. And then, yeah, these guys fell in at just the most opportune time. And really it's the small community we live in here too. That's like this really great music community. So you kind of know of people that play in these bands. And yeah, Joey brought Zach and was like, dude, this is Zach's going to fit perfectly, I think. Let's give him a try.
Yeah. And Rory hit me up. I'd known Rory, you know, like Aaron said, this community is pretty close up here in Humboldt County. And I'd been playing sax around for a bit. And yeah, Rory just kind of called me up one day. He's a guitar player, one of the guitar players. And he said, hey, you know, come on down. And it was the same kind of thing for me as Zach. I walked in and I heard the groove and Zach opened his mouth and me and the trombone player Josh, who showed up at the first practice together, just kind of looked at each other and said, oh yeah, let's fucking do this. Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. And here we are, you know, 2.5 years later, 2 years later.
Yeah. It's super funny how it's like you get into one of these groups and you jam with the intention of jamming and going as far as you can. But that factor, as far as you can, is something that kind of gets laid out before you. You know, we did the jam that is like a little start out venue up here where all these, these college bands will come and kind of like test their mettle at the jam. And then if they can sell that out, then they can move up to like Humbrews is a bigger venue. If you can sell that out, you go to the ATL, it's even bigger. So it was like, it slowly sort of built where we noticed that shows were starting to fill up and
I think at our last show at the jam, when I saw that there was a line out the door and kind of halfway around the block, corner.
Yeah, it was like,
I realized that maybe we shouldn't play the jam anymore.
Right. It was kind of like, oh wow, we're growing up. People are digging this. We gotta. So that just tells you, like, all right, well, I guess then it's time to commit even further and take this on the road. And you're on the road. You saw out a few shows, and you're like, oh shit, I guess we should go even further on the road. And like, it just sort of like the bones get laid out before you, and you can.
Yeah, we're just along for the ride.
Yeah, we're just trying to keep up with it, man. Because it's been things have just been happening, you know. From our recent show in LA went incredibly well. That's a very tough town to bust into musically. Or High Sierra is like, it's a festival that musicians will try to get into for decades sometimes, and only then do they catch a break. But we're sort of making strides in these weird directions, and it's just like, okay, I guess this is happening, and I'm gonna honor it. Like, we better just do it, you know.
And I think a big piece that we don't really always talk about, you know, but, and also as far as how they joined the band and really stayed in the band, is we had tried a few other singers out, and it was kind of sometimes a little more in the reggae vein, or maybe just the people didn't quite jive, you know, and lifestyles didn't fit. But I think really, like, a big piece of the magic is that these guys came in and they not only settled in musically into the groove perfectly, but they settled in just as friends, you know.
Yeah.
It's like we all just kind of kicked it off super quickly. And that's, I think, really what fuels a lot of this band, is like we spend a lot of time together, and
yeah.
And eight people like that, coordinating eight people no matter what you're talking about is definitely can be difficult. And so for us, we're so lucky just because we all just jive as people, you know, before we even pick our instruments up. Or
yeah, I consider these, you know, the other seven guys pretty much my best friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, yeah. Do you guys have a manager?
No, we have a booking agent. And
yeah, we need one. Yeah. You know anyone?
I guess that's maybe the benefit of eight people, is we can divvy up tasks fairly well.
These days, I've been doing, like, tour managing and, like, talking to venues before we get there. Kind of the basics like that. But we have another guy who does the booking. We have half of the band doing different specific avenues of, like, social media, you know, forwarding the posters to venues. What else? God, there's promotion, getting in touch with radio podcasts like this one.
Kind of all that stuff that you really, you know, if you don't actually think about being a band in the business, then you don't really anticipate all this stuff. And that's me, I guess, my side, you know, is like, yeah. I was so happy playing house parties, and I was like, not ready to give that up and take it seriously. But
I know.
So it really came with a lot of responsibilities that, like Zach said, is we're kind of like learning a lot as we're doing this, you know, even as musicians, and how to play better, you know, or more efficiently if you have to play so many nights in a row.
Stage presence.
But then, stage presence is a big one that we've grown with. But really, just getting responsible too, as far as the whole business side of it as well.
Yeah, like we merch orders business. And like there's a guy who handles, you know, merch pricing and merch inventory and merch, you know, reorders. And it's like, it really becomes a business that's much bigger than the music itself. But then the tightrope that you walk is how to maintain passion and raw creativity as musicians, and hold these responsibilities of networking and making it a dollars and cents thing, you know, without losing that magic of it, you know, that's where
I'd love to have a manager so we could focus on that.
That's where help is important.
Make us all happier, for sure.
Well, you guys have clearly been working your asses off. I mean, you guys are getting momentum, and I like that you're divvying up all your tasks to members within the band. I think that's really resourceful, and you're probably leveraging everybody's strengths, or if somebody's better at something.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it sure is fun, man.
So moving forward, are you guys recording any new albums or any projects in the works?
I think
we have enough tunes to kind of
stuff that hasn't been recorded yet, and we're really excited to get in there and get them recorded. We're still in kind of the talking phase as far as getting dates in the books, but we're trying to once again just take it all more seriously and invest more and really kind of continue to put out products that we're really happy and proud of. So we're trying to move maybe beyond Humboldt County for recording and maybe get more professional equipment, studio. So
don't we have a date at?
Well, it's not locked in.
Okay.
So I guess I'm we won't announce that. Yeah.
But essentially, I think what Tyler's getting at is we're talking with studios that use all analog equipment.
Cool.
And that, you know, like they used to use back in the day. You know, we're trying to.
So you're gonna record on tape.
Get back to the original feeling. Yeah, like we want to do reel-to-reel recordings, compress them through analog mixers, old mics, you know, all these things that were put into antiquity for such a long time. They're coming back in the form of like Daptone records and like Coal Mine records, or the one that I forget what it's called, Orgone's place,
Killian
records. Killian Air,
but I mean, it's just this quality of recording that pairs so well with the style of music, you know. Some people say that we, you know, play old style of music, you know, something that's, like Zach said, maybe antiquated in some circles, but
Well, I don't know though.
We're trying to get back to that.
One of my favorite things that I've heard from the audience is we play old music, but it sounds like nothing they've ever heard before.
Yeah, which is people say that a lot, that's for cool. sure.
Yeah. All right.
So that's the next step.
So Aaron, can we dig into your past a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
All right. So Digging Dirt inspired you to, you know, knock off the dust of that saxophone and get out there and keep playing it. But initially, your first fan could arguably be your dog. Is that
you know, I like to think he was a fan. I hope so. But I've started playing saxophone in elementary school. And you know, I'm super grateful for what my parents put up with, because it's really a lot of honking and squeaking and really not very nice sounds coming out then. But I was always there joined by my little dog. He would always just run up next to me whenever I'd practice at home and start howling along with me. And I've met other musicians with this same experience.
Now,
I like to think he was joining in.
Absolutely. Now, I had a dog in the past that would sing along to high notes on the guitar. Did you notice that the dog particularly likes some notes?
That's you know, I bet so. It seemed like he would really tune in on this mid-range, you know. I think the honking would usually just startle him, any low notes. So I think there was a sweet spot that he liked to join in and sing on with.
Well, that's great. So you've already been practicing from your youth about giving space for others to chime in.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right.
Nice.
That was awesome.
All right, so
sounds like a very country Genesis musically. It's like, I'll just, you know,
just howling with the dog.
I'll play my saxophone on the porch.
Yeah, really, the dog's going, shut up, shut up.
You know, I was probably one of the you know, least talented saxophonists. I had never liked practicing. Once I made it to high school, I was really a poor musician, and that He's led shy. To. You know,
You're
me.
Killing it now,
yeah. Bro. You know, I came to college. I went to university and decided to kind of pursue science, and really just steered away from the music world because I'd been doing it so much growing up, and so saxophone was a little more of a like regimented kind of outlet for me. I always played in like symphony bands, you know, sometimes the jazz bands, but it was really more like reading charts and playing what's in front of me. And not a whole lot of improv. I never felt comfortable doing that. But I just put that thing in the closet when I came to Humboldt State University, and it sat there for years. I think at least 4 years, you know, almost my whole time there. And then finally I met Drew and Rory and really just hung out with them for a while. And I'd play guitar a little bit and jam a little bit doing that. But somehow, I don't even know who told them. I know it wasn't me. It's like they found out through a third party that I played saxophone and essentially just required me to come jam with it, even though I hadn't played it in like 5 years.
So how was it?
So it was really this like...
Oh, keep going.
Say it again?
I was just gonna say, how was it picking it up after so long? Was it, did it feel foreign? Was it very difficult to hit the notes that you used to hit easily?
I remember being super apprehensive to do it because I thought I was just gonna totally suck, like that it would just sound like crap. Because my notion was that I would not remember how to do anything, how to even blow on that thing, right? And so it's incredible how much was muscle memory, though. A lot of it was still in the fingers, but yeah, my tone was definitely poor, and my remembrance of music theory was super rough, and it still is. But so it did take a while for it to really sound good. But I mean, the thing was, it's like, no one was this stellar musician, you know, like there was no expectations. We were really just having fun with what we were playing, and it was like garage quality stuff that we just all still loved, you know. I remember we just had the laptop, honestly, on the other side of the living room, and we'd press record on GarageBand when we would be jamming, and it was just all for fun. It was all just for us. So, but it was this great crash course that allowed me to dust off the cobwebs and really just put in time that I didn't even think of it as practice. It was just getting together to jam, but it really was formative in allowing me to really kind of get good at playing the saxophone again. But even like Zach with singing, you know, as I'm still an amateur, there's still tons that I'm sure I could be doing better as a saxophonist. And I'm figuring it out ultimately through Crash Course and just us playing a lot of these gigs. But like Tyler said earlier too, going to jam crews and seeing these professional horn players really was a kick in the butt. And it inspired me to start doing more reading on how to play saxophone and really kind of get back in all that stuff I learned back way back when, but take it more seriously this time and choose to be a good saxophonist, you know, instead of just one that can carry the vibe well enough.
Absolutely. All right. Well,
yeah.
Tyler, quick question for you.
Yeah.
You know, you started out playing at a young age. You had family that were musicians. Is that correct?
Yeah, my dad, music's been a huge part of my life. My father and his two brothers have a long history in Southern California. And my grandfather was a music teacher, actually, and so it's been in the family.
And you started out playing for your family, I believe, right? At some fireside chats or fireside performances?
Yeah, I was, I would go, and I was like two or three, and my mom would take me out, and I'd look through the window of some club and see my dad on stage playing, and, you know, whatever all ages concerts, I'd see him play, and it became, you know, it's my dad. So I was focused on it. That was my world, and it was cool to see him up there. And I, you know, he'd let me come up and dance on stage for, there was one band that he'd play in a park, and I would come up and dance on stage to a bunch of James Brown covers when I was three. And, they ended up buying me, a plastic toy saxophone so I could just be like dad. And then I would insist that the family all sit around. We had a mantle on our fireplace, brick mantle, and I'd get up on there because there was clearly a stage, and I'd force the family to sit around and watch me and just honk away and, you know, and play on this shitty little toy saxophone. And they supported that because they were all performers.
Do you have a hat there passing around for tips?
Yeah. I don't know. They gave me a place to sleep
food. That counts. That counts. But that's amazing, having that support in the house and welcoming and encouraging and getting you your first instrument to kind of get the idea planted that, hey, this could be something that you could do.
Yeah. I don't think they even meant to. I think it just was, you know, I was interested in it, and so they cultivated that, and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, your family is so cool about having that in their space. We hung out with them like last year on tour. We got to go stay with Tyler's family, and we like, I don't know, it was really cool. It was just a musical space, you know. We ended up recording some cool tracks when you were down there.
Yeah, I think we recorded that. It's a pretty cool version of Summertime that we did. Me and you and Josh.
Yeah, yeah. Scott just, you know, Scott.
Scott's my dad.
He just has, like, recording set up, old, like, alto saxophones from, you know, before the 1950s, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And just, yeah, he just has it all there, and he's just, like, so, he's so, what's the word? It's supportive of it.
Encouraging. Yeah. It's his passion, man. He's, you know, he's a professional musician, and that's what he does. That's his life.
Yeah.
That's and awesome. I mean, it's just going off that, we got a lot of love from our family, you know, every one of our parents, family, siblings, we get so much support from them, whether like we're on the road and in town and they'll come out or give us a place to stay, but then they just truly love our music too.
Yeah.
And it's just something I know we're all grateful for, but we're really lucky too to have family that wants to support, you know, their children as musicians, because it's not a lucrative thing for us at all right now. You know, we all, you know, can dream big, but it's notoriously a tough lifestyle to maintain, and we get so much love and support from all of our family. Yeah, we're grateful.
Absolutely.
And I mean, that's, you're speaking the truth. I mean, a musician's life is not the gravy train necessarily. And it's hard to build up that audience and to get those followers. And you guys are doing a great job. I mean, you're talking about selling out your local venues and realizing that there's a line. You're like, oh, maybe we should go to the next step up and then the next step up. And you keep getting those fans.
That's humbling. It's good.
And the festivals are an amazing scene too, because you get a cross-pollination of music that draws in people from all kinds of different backgrounds that might not have ever heard
So just all these different places that they come from.
I mean, but given that you're always on the move as a musician, you're touring, you're playing new stages, new venues, new speakers, new people, new, you know, sound engineers and stuff, Zach, you know, could you walk me through, you know, some of the stuff that goes wrong during this?
Oh man, well, let me tell you, there is always something. You know?
and how do you kind of play on and let it roll off your shoulder and not throw you off for the night?
Yeah. Oh man.
Deep breaths.
I think that's really the name of the game, is like your adaptability is something that really gets exercised on a tour, especially because every night that we go to a new place, we're dealing with the dynamics of a new room. We're dealing with the dynamics of different sound equipment that the house provides and a different sound technician that has a taste and an ear for the music that we're maybe not used to. Or they're just like, there's places that just were never meant to have gigs thrown there. We had this one gig in Placerville I can think of where, it was like a roadhouse bar. It was like a biker bar. And they had a PA head, but no cables. And they were like, you guys brought all the cables, right? And we're like,
no. We're never told to.
And so we called in a bunch of favors. We called some friends from around there. They brought cables. We got that hooked up. And we get things rolling. It sounds okay. You know, it's not the best mix, but it'll work, you know. And then halfway through a song, someone bumps into a light switch, and that light switch was rigged to the PA system. Everything, we just go dead. You know, it's just like
so mid-song silence.
Drums. Yeah, No, but I mean, there's the amps are still working, and the drums are still making noise, but all the mics are gone. The mains are gone. So you know what do you do? I mean, I just turned to my band and I said, keep playing. You know, just keep vamping on this thing, and then I'll figure this out. And I hop off stage, I go find the light switch that got, I'm like flickering lights through the room while they're vamping, and then I find the one that is rigged to the PA. It flips on, and it goes poof, and everything's back. And then, you know, you have to just take it in stride, roll up back to the stage like nothing ever happened and kill it, you know, just like sing as, you know, with passion and just pretend that nothing ever happened. And that's really like, that's really the tour, like that's your gift on tour. And the thing that you have to really bear in mind is just like, dude, roll with it. Just roll with it, you know. Yeah. It's never gonna be perfect,
yeah.
But you can always make it fun, and you can always, if something comes around or goes awry, you can always have an epic comeback, you know.
I love that mentality.
Broadcast feedback to the audience.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you know, the Redwood Curtain Show.
Yeah, we blasted out the audience with a bunch of feedback. The sound guy decided that everything was hooked up wrong, so he unhooked it in the middle of the tune or something and turned the sound system back on. Really what was happening was, I don't know, it was just so much feedback, we had to shut the system down, stop the show, and take like 20 minutes to rewire. Yeah.
That people were like holding their ears because it was just the most wretched noises coming out of the PA.
That's one of the worst. It feels so bad.
That was embarrassing. Yeah.
Luckily, that time we had an extra PA head, you know, like the brain, the unit. And so we just tossed over the old one and put on the new one and re-leveled everything really, really quick. But then the rest of the show, dude, the rest of the show was amazing. It was a packed house. Like, you couldn't stand in there.
Yeah, people were on the stairs behind us, looking down at us, all kinds of shit.
It was like, it was like the worst thing that could have happened, but because we just thought on our feet and came back with it, with enthusiasm, I think that spoke even louder to people, that we weren't swayed by some bullshit that happened. we got the hell down, man. It was so cool.
Yeah, that's like something that we all agree upon. It's like, no matter what, we need to maintain this experience, you know, because as music lovers, we've gone to shows, we know what, like, as an audience member, it can be like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've realized that, like, you know, we're there to provide something to the people that are out there to see us. And so we just all agree that, like, no matter what kind of shit we may be given, like, whatever the problem is, you know, whatever the twist and turn is, we just know that we still are there to do something that, you know, we love to do and the people love to see us doing. So we all know that we just, once we're up there and we're in it and we're doing it, no matter what, we just maintain that positivity. We maintain the groove and we just enjoy ourselves. And, you know, maybe later that night when we're in the van heading home or something, we can decompress and be like, what the fuck happened out there? But, you know, a lot of the time it's really hard to face us and to make us not enjoy what we're doing still. And people pick up on that, you know, and we get a lot of feedback about that, is that they really see that we enjoy it, you know, and that allows them to. And so it's hard to steer us awry, you know. It takes a real train wreck that we haven't even experienced, you know, and hopefully never will, to really take out that groove from us. Mm-hmm. So.
Great. So tell me about that, like, mental game. When you're going on stage right before you get on a new venue or a new festival, bigger crowd than you've ever played in front of, there's got to be a little bit of nerves and anxiety going through. Mm. But how do you work together or internally to kind of quiet your mind and come out and present yourself in the way you want to be?
Well, I've always thought that nerves have this dual effect. You can have a nervous feeling and let it paralyze you and make you afraid, or that nervous feeling can sort of shut off a certain part of your brain where you just do and you like zero in, because it's do or die. It's right now. People are watching, or this is like the biggest thing you've ever done. So it's like you have to think about it a little bit. Nerves, I think, for me as a vocalist, they're always there. I've never not been at least a little bit nervous, but it's what you do with that that crazy feeling. I've even had nights where, like, horrible, tragic things were happening in my life right before a gig. And then you see the crowd and you see, like, oh shit, it's now, it's right now.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah, the show has to start whether you're nervous or not.
Yeah. And you, it's like your brain shuts off and you you go into this place in your head where you're listening to your own sound, not like you're making it, but you're just allowing it to happen and allowing it to come through. I think that's the proper use of nerves.
I think for me too, when once you get on stage, it really, it's like this special space, a special, I don't know, section of your brain that your consciousness steps into that really, it's different. You know, I can feel like shit, I have a hangover, whatever the fuck, and I get on stage and all of a sudden I'm like, oh yeah, I'm back on stage. This is almost what I'm living for. And I got to bring the vibe for these people in the audience. I got to play my part well, you know, and I get to be up there with these guys that I consider family. And it's just, it's a totally different headspace. And for me, it takes me and it, I don't have a choice but to be in it.
Some ancient peoples and musical cultures, I believe they referred to this as getting saucy as a mother bitch.
Ancient scripts.
Yeah. Must have been the Greeks.
So in the old times. Yes.
Yeah,
so we used to be much more nervous when we were first starting at the beginning and, you know, only playing locally still. We would totally feel, and you'd see it on our faces, you know. We were nervous for sure, but I think it's pretty cool how we really grew quickly as individuals. I mean, there was a time where none of us danced on stage, you know. It was like we were all too self-conscious and
that's boring.
And it's boring. You realize that's boring, and we played dance music. Of course, it's in us. We want to be dancing, and so we've kind of just like grown, maybe not even consciously, but just through playing over and over, and it's great how we've really gotten comfortable with each other. And like Tyler said, we get up there and it's just like this thing that us as eight friends have done now enough to feel like we can just do it. We just know we can. And so for me personally, I've lost a lot of that nervous feeling. We get up there, and I mean, sure, now that we've been doing festivals this summer, it is different, you know, it's a different kind of feeling, but even then, we just know what we're going to play, and we're comfortable playing together. And really, what I think we're lucky is that people enjoy our music, you know, and it's this positive feedback loop that we're riding.
For sure.
And once you see people moving in the audience, it's just 100 times easier.
Yeah,
it's
start to feel real good.
Yeah, you just feel good about what's going on. Yeah. And
one thing is definitely true. If you want people to get down moderately, you need to get down heavily, you know.
Yeah.
If you want people to bleed for you, you have to hemorrhage for them. And so I think in that way there isn't much room for self-conscious behavior.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. Yeah,
we've all kind of rid ourselves of it, I guess. And
you got to be a clown on stage.
You're a total egotist, you know, just...
look at me.
Well, speaking of being on stage and being in character, Zach, you've got some of the best outfits out there. You know, where are you getting these?
Oh, man. I think my useless human superpower... is finding and locating bell bottoms and like vintage shit.
Yeah. A lot of thrift stores.
Yeah, a lot of thrift stores. Festivals seem to be they're coming out with a lot of these like vendors and sort of down home designers are coming out with more funky kind of 70s like.
Yeah, the funk is back.
Yeah, the funk is coming back and a lot of these people, they see you perform and they're excited about it. They're excited about the music and the era that you're emulating. So I've had the hookup sometimes. Just like people, they're like, oh dude, your music reminds me of this. I totally have this thing you should wear. And then, you know, you just end up with cool stuff. But yeah, I like to make that. I mean, I don't want to focus on image too much, but I like to, I don't know, it just makes me feel funky. It makes me feel like I'm providing another dimension to the experience.
Absolutely.
And, I have all these weird ideas about funky things. Like, there's a song about a milkman. I'm like, dude, what if I wore a cow, what if I wore a cow suit with like working udders and like spray the audience with milk?
Yeah, we vetoed like, that one.
Yeah, these guys don't always see the genius in what
but it's that doing. It's that same idea Zach said earlier, you know, like you really got to give 150% if you want the audience to give 100%, you know.
Yeah,
and so we've just accepted that we got to look crazy up there, and we enjoy doing it, and so we're always looking out for something wherever we are. We check the thrift stores, and we have an idea of who needs what, you know, like everyone, you know, gets, we're just slowly accruing this stuff, and it's just fun for us.
Oh, that's great. I mean, the visual aspect, I mean, music is an experience, especially live. It's not just audible. Yeah. So like you're mentioning, just your presence on stage and being able to be comfortable enough to dance changes the vibe of the music, even though the music hasn't changed, but your presence has kind of invited other people to let loose. So it is important.
Well said.
And you were talking about how you were wearing white at one of those barn parties and just rolled around in the dirt to be very to be very literal, but also visual, you know. And and it's branding.
Or what was that Halloween show? There was that Halloween show where all the whole band was dressed. They were all dressed in like matching prisoner uniforms.
Yeah, you were a sheriff.
And I was like their sheriff, like barking orders. I had like a whistle. I was like, they rolled around in some dirt that night too. But it really does. It offers a sort of just a coolness. Like it's fun to look at from the perspective of someone who's like down in the audience. Maybe it's super crowded and packed. Like. It's just fun. It's a fun vibe to be like, oh wow, they look at that. Look at them do that thing. It just adds another element of like immersion into the experience.
Great. Well, thanks so much for sharing all that. So I'm kind of wrapping up, but I just wanted to ask you guys, what advice would you give to a musician starting out today? Maybe a younger musician, a younger sibling, or somebody kind of graduating high school who's looking to take it up a level.
Yeah.
Practice and listen and listen to the music you want to play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good in, good out.
Make sure you love what you're playing. You know, I think that's something we don't all think about very often, but we're super lucky to have is that we all just enjoy the music we're playing.
Yeah. Love what you play, whether or not it's marketable.
Yeah.
You know, if you're lucky, it's marketable and you get to take it on the road or whatever. But, you know, I really have always felt like the music that I love to play, I would play it in my bedroom if no one gave a single flying fuck about it. I would still be like, oh, well, this is what I like. And you can never lose that no matter what other people think. But, yeah, I mean, if you're lucky and if you work hard enough, you can do it, man. It just takes time.
Yeah,
you can't lose hope. You always have to just keep grinding, man.
Good support network definitely helps.
Yeah, meet people.
Yeah. But I mean, really, it's tough to give advice. I feel like we're still such noobs, you know. Like, we're still figuring it out ourselves.
No, we're professional.
Professional.
Yeah, we are definitely.
You should pass.
I mean, right? Yeah.
Totally pass. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, everybody's had a different stage in their career, and you guys could definitely inspire and help out some younger or aspiring musicians. And I know you guys have a long road ahead of you. So I wish you well on that journey.
Thank you, Mike.
And I just wanted to kind of give the last question to you guys and say, hey, is there anything else that you'd like to share or plug, links, social stuff, anything?
Yeah, hit our website, diggingdirtband.com. Go from there.
Yeah, that's the hub. I think what you else? Can find everything from there.
Yeah, we're on iTunes, Spotify. Yeah, we've been noticing that there's been more listener activity in Colorado, so we're hoping.
We're excited to get there.
Yeah, we really want to get over there. So stay tuned for that. Yeah. There should be something in the wheelhouse.
Yeah, and we're on tour right now, so
yeah,
check it out.
And I know from all of us here and even the other five dudes that aren't here with us, we're all just super thankful for the love, support. You know, this whole experience is something that we're blown away by. And we're happy to be doing it and look forward to keep doing it. And
we'll keep bringing the funk.
Yeah.
And big up to you, Mike. It means a lot to have someone take an interest like that and want to delve in and pick our brains.
Yeah, it's from a afar really, like this.
Really an honor, man.
Thank you. Kicked.
This episode was brought to you by Frio Labs, bringing to life creative, innovative, and always custom website designs. Need a website? Learn more at friolabs.com. Need a discount? Use the coupon code FMPODCAST for 10% off of your order. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.